This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the stage of history.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Hello and welcome to the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod episode 71. After the high of episode 70 and Tom's triumphant return as host, settle in for a wild ride with me, your guest host, Andrew. You may know me from guesting in earlier episodes, my own podcast, Dreamcast Years, or my book, Dreamcast Year One, available now, shameless plug. Before we get into what we're really here for, though, let me introduce you to the Dreamcast Junkyard staples, who you'll no doubt recognise more so than myself. The first of my co-hosts is the collector himself, the man whose epic A to Z of Dreamcast Games book has reached a staggering 4,958 downloads. It's Mike. How are you?
Evening, Andrew. I'm very good. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very good.
Nobody's recognising Mike, I tell you, because you can actually hear him today with his new fancy microphone.
Yeah, I'm the one with a really strong pirate accent that you're going to hear now.
Awesome. Great Mike. Great Mike. So we're going to hear lots of Mike through his new mic as we go through the episode. Next up is the gentleman who launched a brand new podcast recently, the Series X podcast. Listen now. No, wait, after this one. It's the lovely James.
Hello.
One quick question for you. How's Stadia?
It's okay, is probably the best way I can just answer that quickly.
Okay.
I've got a game I'm playing at the moment, which I figure we're going to do what we're currently playing, so I'll elaborate then.
Okay. Sure. We'll see. last but not least, a phrase he hears more often than he probably should. It's someone who's been doing some excellent investigative journalism for the Junkyard of late and also playing Uno DX on the Saturn so that you don't have to. It's Lewis. How's it going, Lewis?
Hello. I'm not so bad. Kind of as a sequel because James gave the response to last episode about whether or not Stadia is good. My response to last episode is Tom got me the Dynamite Cop manual, so I'm very happy.
Amazing. So you've got a complete copy now, which is what everybody wants, really. It's quite an expensive game, isn't it, Dynamite Cop now? Am I right in thinking?
Yeah. I'm very lucky to have Tom get me that manual so I didn't have to buy even more stuff to contribute to that game, yeah.
Absolutely. So, since I'm in charge today, I thought that I'd change things up a little bit, James, so you might be disappointed slightly. What better way to honour the podcast and site that I've followed for years and have been really excited to host than to do it all differently? this time, we're not going to go over everybody's recent pickups and games that have been playing. And instead, we're going to have a little bit of a chat about our Dreamcast origin stories as a little bit of an icebreaker. After that, just so you know what's coming up later, we're going to discuss the games that Capcom released for the Dreamcast. And there's quite a few, and quite a lot of them are really good. Spoiler alert. So, should we get started? I think, should we go oldest to youngest? I'm going to guess. I think I know the ages of everybody.
What the? Hang on. What's going on here? This is
Mike. I'm going to either really offend somebody here, or I'm going to get this totally right. Mike, first up.
Mike, how old are you, if you don't mind sharing? There's no way you're older than me.
What year were you born, James?
1980. Are we still on the same? The same.
Yeah, same decade.
Three.
No, 80.
Sorry.
That's all right. I just, you know, I feel even older now than my usual daily excursions to work and everyone looking at me as some kind of old man. But it's all right. I don't mind. Good start to the podcast. yes, I am the oldest one, apparently.
I'm not going to get asked back, am I? I'm just going to just be my first and last hosting gig. Sorry, Mike. So yeah, your origin story. How did you first?
Well, back in the midst of time, back when it was black and white TVs and everything. So I had a job. My first job I got when I was 18, 19. was working for a retailer. Same job I got now, so I'm not going to mention any names. But I sort of remember having the console in the shop when I was first there. And I'd sort of gone off console gaming for a while. I was a big PC gamer. So I didn't really play consoles at all. And then very shortly after Christmas that year, after I bought a PC, my first purchase was a console, which was Dreamcast. Sort of, I grew up with the Master System and the Mega Drive, so I loved the Sega consoles. Never played Saturn when I was younger. And then I sort of bought a Dreamcast, and then I sort of played it as my main console, my only console for a few years. More of a sport, sort of a casual game, I suppose you could say, for the Dreamcast. So although I loved, I'm going to say proper games, really annoyed lots of people, but I liked proper games on a PC. But on Dreamcast, it was very much sort of sports games and racing games. Had it as sort of a casual sort of console, I moved away with an ex-girlfriend, and the only thing I brought with me was a Dreamcast. So that sort of rekindled my feelings for Dreamcast again. And then several years after that, when I met my now wife, I also found out she also had a Dreamcast, and she was younger. And so it literally, everywhere I go in my life, Dreamcast seems to keep on popping back up again. So,
wow.
Hearing Mike describe himself as a casual Dreamcast gamer is one of the most hilarious comments I've ever heard in my entire life.
It's the guy
that owns every copy of every game from every region.
Yeah.
The weird. I don't have every single game. Not yet.
Nearly.
But yeah, until sort of probably 5 years ago, I'd never really played many shoot 'em ups. Never really played many fighting games. I wasn't a big fan of them anyway. So yeah, it's been a journey for me the last 10 years as well. Obviously, I was big into first person shooters and narrative driven games back on the PC at that time. But never really into, you know, I think I bought Shenmue quite early on, 2001 probably. Didn't ever play it until I was away. That had the effect on me then, still. But I think the games I remember from when I was younger, NBA 2K, MSR, which was fantastic at its own. Yeah. Crazy Taxi, obviously. Sonic Adventure, obviously. But yeah, very much a sort of I wouldn't class myself as someone who was, even though I had a Dreamcast back in the day and I bought the magazines, I was never really full on. It was always my second platform.
Mm. I mean, sounds like you kind of met the right person, your wife, considering she also had a Dreamcast in her youth. That kind of, did you realize right then and then when you realized that she also had one? Was that it? Was it like perfect?
That's what it is. Getting married. Exactly, yeah, exactly. The Dreamcast had me at Dreamcast.
There you go.
But I'm saying that in a sort of a slightly humorous way, but actually I'm taking my wife to see Sonic the Hedgehog movie on Valentine's Day, so I shouldn't really joke much more because she's going to kill me as it is. for me, the Dreamcast has always been something which has been there. Keeps on popping back up again. So like, the first day I started collecting or going for a PAL set, I walked into a charity shop and bought two games, 50 pence each. One was Street Fighter 3 Double Impact, I think it was. So really, like, sort of just these random things happened. Like, I went to Cardiff to go to the name of the shop in Cardiff now. James, you help me out here. What's the name of the game shop in Cardiff?
I feel like this is a trick question. You don't need to say game.
No.
Super Tomato?
That's the one. I went to Super Tomato to play some Dreamcast games, and Adam Kolick was in the shop. You know, sort of like odd things that happened throughout my throughout the last 10 years. Very strange.
So it's been a bit of a love affair with the Dreamcast, and it's been there throughout the big moments of your life, by the sounds of it.
You want to say obsession, Andrew? It's fair.
Obsession. Yeah. We'll call it that. let's move on to the next person, the next oldest, and now you've given it away, James.
Oh, sorry.
Because I wasn't sure if you're older or younger than me. Now I know that you're older than me. James, you're next.
So my love affair, I think I've touched on this story before. The first kind of console I really got into, as a proper, quote, hardcore gamer, if you can call it that, was the original PlayStation. I played games before, but the original PlayStation was the first kind of time I started actually looking at games coming out and pre-ordering stuff, whereas before it was like going to a game shop and just look at all these great things on the shelf. And the kind of natural evolution to that then was that when the Dreamcast sort of hype was starting, I was 15 at the time. And it was just something that I kind of followed from the very early announcements all the way through, to the point where, as a 15-year-old with very, very, very little money, I was thinking, can I scrape enough pennies together here to potentially get a Japanese import? And that's how desperate I was to get a Dreamcast on launch. It turned out that my sort of £10 a month pocket money didn't stretch quite that far, and I wasn't working at this point. So long story short, I saved almost every penny that I had. My birthday is in November. So whilst I class myself as a launch window, I didn't actually make the Dreamcast launch in the UK. But I always have memories of trying to convince my best mate to buy a Dreamcast as well. And I remember from Game, they kind of had this little sort of 4-page pre-order pamphlet thing, which had all the launch games and the accessories and stuff. And it was pinned on my pin board for months. And I managed to get him to do the same at his house. So we were both kind of counting down towards it. Anyway, my 16th birthday rolls by and my parents give me the remaining amount that I needed to go and buy my Dreamcast. And that evening we went down to, I believe it was like a Comet, I think, picked up a Dreamcast, couldn't quite stretch to a game though. So from November through to Christmas Day, I basically survived off the Dreamcast demo disc that you got in the box and the first two Dreamcast magazine demos. Luckily there was quite on Dream On, the first one that you kept in the box, there's quite a few demos on there, and that's when my obsession with Monaco Grand Prix started. And then just Dreamcast was a lot of firsts for me. I was, you know, massively into online gaming, and I never had a gaming PC, never did anything on PC at all. So you know, getting on the internet and just generally browsing with the keyboard, and obviously playing things like Toy Racer and Phantasy Star Online and Choo Choo Rocket, much to my mum's annoyance, as the phone line was run across the hallway into my bedroom to the early hours of the morning. And it's just been, as I said, I think it was at that time in my life when, as I said, you sort of starting to get a bit of independence. I started working shortly after, which meant I had a bit of disposable income to spend on games. And yeah, it was just, it's always had that special place for me because of the timing of it all. And as I said, it just, the games that came out from it, I think I was probably the last generation to sort of, you know, still go to arcades and play, you know, the latest beat 'em ups or whatever it was. And the Dreamcast was really the first kind of opportunity to have that experience in your, it was the first time where games stopped looking better in the arcades, put it that way, than they did at home. So yeah, that was kind of my story, really. There was no real sort of standout game that attracted me. It was just, as a young 15-year-old, it was the lure of new technology that I could actually get my teeth into before it even got released. Oh, and the one thing I did mention, I think on the last podcast, it was actually going into Game and playing on an imported Japanese console, playing Power Stone, which was the real kind of, it was the moment that it looked as good as it did in real life, as it did in all the screenshots and CVG magazine up to that point. So, so that's me. And I would tweet out a 16-year-old picture of me, or a 16-year-old me still playing on my Dreamcast on my birthday for everyone's viewing pleasure.
It's a great picture. This is the one you sent in our WhatsApp group, isn't it? Yes. That was a great picture. Very nostalgic. Like everything in the picture, the posts on the wall.
Very 90s bedroom.
Very 90s. And you mentioned like Comet as well. It just kind of reminded me how many shops that we used to buy games from have just like, they've just ceased to exist. Like pretty much all of them, really. Like Electronics Boutique, Game Station, all gone, which is quite sad.
And Game almost, to be honest.
Oh yeah, pretty much. That's cool. Now, technically, if we're going in date order, kind of birth order, I should be next, but I'm host and I've got a segue planned. So I'm going to go to the youngest next, which I know to be Lewis, because again, in the WhatsApp group, we were all horrified to learn how much older than Lewis we are. Lewis, what's your Dreamcast origin story?
Okay. So as Andrew's just pointed out, and I was teased for a fair bit in the WhatsApp group, I was 7 at the time that the Dreamcast was released. Yeah, I basically knew one single person. Well, technically I had brothers as well, but he was my main friend. He had a Dreamcast, and I never knew anyone, never met anyone else then or as I was growing up who had one. And I remember every time I went round, I'd be nagging him, can we play Quake 3 Arena and Power Stone 2? I remember there being a time where he was just like, I don't want to play Power Stone 2, it's rubbish. And I just like spent the whole day saying, please, 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 like begging him because I just loved the game so much. And what really attracted me back then was the multiplayer, the fact that you could play four player. And I'd never seen games that looked as good as that, you know, that you could play with that many people all at once. You know, I was used to seeing a lot of single player experiences, watching other people play and ones I'd play myself. And it was just absolutely mind blowing to me. And even though my kind of Dreamcast love story was like 10 years later when I was in college, I feel like those memories during college were quite similar in a way to some of the guys at the junkyard. You know, it was my first ever job, which was at the local cinema. And when I'd get paid, basically everything I could muster up would go towards getting Dreamcast games. I didn't have a PS3 or an Xbox 360 or a Wii. It was too expensive for me at the time. And a lot of the games of the seventh generation didn't really interest me. I found a lot of the big titles at the time to be a little bit drab and grey, you know, like Call of Duty and things. And then I found the console, the Dreamcast, which I'd rediscovered at the time, you know, sort of having a bit of a nostalgia trip and looking up these old games. And I just found that so many of the games are just unique and colourful. And it was kind of like a contrast to what was being released at the time from, you know, modern games. And they still held up quite well, you know, despite being from, you know, the previous generation. And at the time as well, the games were affordable, a lot more affordable for me than, you know, the new AAA title. So it's kind of like I was in the right place at the right time as well, because we had this kind of secondhand CX shop. Andrew, you may know this chain because you're from Brighton. It was called GameStar. You may have seen that in Brighton, but there was one in the town where I lived, and the guy there was just basically bringing in Dreamcast games all the time and, you know, giving really generous offers on them. So I fell in love with single player games like Shenmue and Jet Set Radio, ones that I'd not played when I was young at my friend's house. And these probably turned out to be some of the greatest experiences I've ever had with any gaming system. But for me, it was still about that multiplayer. For me, a lot of the games that I was buying around them were formed around the idea of, you know, which of these games can I play with my friends? And so in like probably around 2011, all my friends from college would go to my house. We'd play Dreamcast. It'd be an absolutely great time. And then we'd go and get dinner at the pub down my road, and we'd all just be laughing about the games we'd just been playing. And that became a monthly tradition. And, you know, I remember it like, you know, so fondly, you know, such a great time. And often they'd come to my house and I'd be like, oh, I bought this game off eBay, you know, and we'd have more to play. So, yeah, that's my story. And although I love playing it as a kid, I think those sort of college years were like more important and more nostalgic for me, you know, and those times I spent with friends. So, yeah, it was everything around then just seemed to point towards the Dreamcast. So, yeah, that's my story.
Nice. It's it's weird how yours kind of matches kind of everybody else's in a way, even though it was like a decade later on and after the Dreamcast has kind of gone. And there seems to be something about that, having that experience at a certain time in your life with a console that kind of really makes it special, I suppose. So you being able to have that experience, you know, when you were in your college years must have cemented that in your head, and also having that experience at seven as well and remembering it later on, it's pretty awesome.
To add to that, actually that GameStar no longer exists, so there's another shop that we to add to the list of Dreamcast game shops that no longer exist from our stories.
so many, and there's a lot of the independent ones, like so to kind of go into slightly my story on that would be, my Dreamcast was bought from a secondhand kind of independent game shop in Lincoln. I have no idea what it was called. I can picture where it was on the high street, like with almost precision. If I was to drive down it today, I could tell you whereabouts it was and what it looked like inside. It was so basic, but it was just full of games. And I got into gaming in my kind of like, I guess when I was 8 or 9, but it was very casual. Like Mike said, it would be a very casual gamer at that point. And it was just kind of the SNES. I think we just had one as a family. It wasn't mine. It was the family. So we would just kind of play various games and I could take it or leave it. You know, these were the days where you went out and played outside with your friends. So I was doing a lot of that. And it wasn't until my stepsister brought over her PlayStation. And I think that must have been like, what, 95, 96? Probably 96. And I got way into Resident Evil, which was out in 96, as I recall. I think that's right. And that got me into gaming. I was like, wow. And I've said this, I think I could, however many pods ago it was that I was on and we were talking about Dreamcast Year One, kind of what got me into the Dreamcast was Resident Evil, because Resident Evil Code Veronica was coming exclusively to the Dreamcast. And as soon as I found that out, I was like, I really need this console. I had no previous experience with Sega whatsoever. I think I'd played a Mega Drive once. I'd been Nintendo and then Sony up until that point. But because it had Resident Evil, it was then a must have. And so I got one on my 16th birthday. I got Crazy Taxi and Power Stone with it. And it was from then on that I just kind of fell in love with it, kind of found other people online back in the days of message boards and chat rooms who also loved Dreamcast and started writing for Dreamcast Source. And it was interesting hearing you talk about, Lewis, about being in college and having your friends come over and play Dreamcast and then kind of going to the pub and chatting about the crazy games afterwards. It's kind of what happened to me in university, which was that we, you know, I had my Dreamcast. I think I had Samba de Amigo and Power Stone 2 and, you know, all those kind of crazy, weird, bizarre multiplayer games. And we just sit around drinking, some people smoking weed, which is probably never a good idea when you're playing something like Samba de Amigo. And just, you know, going crazy about these fantastic multiplayer games that we'd just not seen the likes of before. So yeah, there was absolutely something about being in college or university and experiencing those games that, you know, there's just nothing like it. And it's kind of led me on since then to, you know, I never got rid of my Dreamcast. I've always had a Dreamcast collection of sorts, even though I've kind of sold games over the years because of hard times or, you know, foolishness occasionally. And that kind of led me a couple of years ago to wanting to write the book. So, you know, kind of like Mike as well, it's the Dreamcast has been there with me throughout everything. And my game boxes tell that story as well, because I've had so many moves over the years that my Dreamcast collection has, I don't think I've got very many crack-free cases or cases with hinges that work, which is just a testament to how many times I've had to put all of my games into boxes and hope that they don't break on the way, and then inevitably have them break on the way to a new house. So yeah, that's kind of my very short origin story, because I feel like I've already told it a little bit on a previous podcast. So right, unless there's anything anybody else wants to, I am kind of curious, James, as to the game you wanted to talk about. I feel bad for taking that away from you. So I kind of want to know what it was you wanted to talk about now.
So every month on Stadia, they have it's like a pro service where they basically give you a number of games for quote free, which is similar to like Xbox Games with Gold and PlayStation Plus and stuff. And the game this month is the only Stadia exclusive at the moment, is a game called Guilt. But it is basically a survival horror-y Resident Evil, Silent Hill type inspired game with a bit more of a cutesy kind of graphical style. You take control of a schoolgirl. She must be probably like 10, 11, something like that. And she's going through the school with all these creepy looking monsters and stuff. But it's really excellent. And as a huge survival horror fan and Resident Evil fan, as we'll be discussing later, I'm sure, it really resonated with me. And it just kind of, I really, especially in my older years, I really appreciate a more sort of slower paced game than the sort of twitch gameplay that you get on most modern games these days. So I quite like a game that I can sort of take my time. There's not necessarily a stealth game, but ones that you can kind of, you know, methodically kind of go through and at your own pace. So yeah, that was my current played, which I would wholeheartedly recommend. And I hope, I believe it, I don't know if it's timed exclusive or if it is a only ever out on Stadia, but I hope it comes to other consoles because it's really good.
Fingers crossed then. Sounds good. And actually, you've probably given me a better segue than I'd given myself. So thanks for that.
It was all planned.
There you go.
It was so planned. So talking about survival horror games, we're going to move on to chatting about Capcom. So I feel like I'm just talking about what we do in our WhatsApp group at the moment, but we were having a chat about what we wanted to discuss in the podcast, and Lewis kind of came up with the idea of chatting about developers and the games that they released on the console. You know, obviously we all know Sega's output, and I'm sure at some point we might talk about them as a developer, but one of the big ones, the biggest probably outside of Sega for releasing games on the Dreamcast, was Capcom. Obviously well known for their fighting games and a bunch of other games that we'll discuss. But for me, and obviously for James as well, survival horror games are kind of what we love Capcom for, or I love Capcom for. And as I said, Resident Evil was the game that got me into the Dreamcast. So that being a Capcom game, I thought we'd best start with those. And why not start with the one that came first, and that was Resident Evil Code Veronica. So does anybody want to start us off with kind of having a chat about Resident Evil Code Veronica?
I'd be happy to. Yeah. So I, as I said, huge survival horror fan. Resident Evil on the PlayStation was one of my favorite games. I think, again, being a sort of 14-year-old at the time playing it, it just was even more scarier and atmospheric and amazing. And obviously went through then Resident Evil 2. And when I got the Dreamcast, as probably a lot of people were who were into that sort of genre, there was a lot of fuss being made over Code Veronica being obviously an exclusive at the time to the Dreamcast, and also it being the first kind of entry that was not pre-rendered from a background perspective. And I remember getting super hyped for this. It was a pre-order as soon as I could at the time. Another game store that went bust quite a while ago now was an online one, Gameplay. I don't know if anyone used Gameplay. I still have a Gameplay sticker on my Dreamcast, interesting or not interesting fact. Pre-ordered from there, and yeah, remember getting it and just being instantly blown away by just how good it could look in 3D and how different the game felt, but still felt eerily the same, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I thought it was. I mean, I would say the last kind of the last Resident Evil game that I super enjoyed, because I kind of went off the series a bit when from Resident Evil 4 onwards, but I think I'd probably say Resident Evil 0 was probably the last one I super enjoyed. But yeah, in the sake of the Dreamcast, I thought it was amazing. I loved the story, loved the characters, and loved the 3D world rather than the pre-rendered stuff.
Yeah, there's definitely something about the 3D-ness, is that what that's a word? 3D, the 3D-ness of it. It gave a lot more. I mean, the camera angles for a start off, you know, the fact that you could actually have a camera that followed you down a hallway rather than being static in the, you know, in the corner. Mike, is there anything in particular that you remember about Code Veronica? Is it one that you enjoyed at the time?
At the time, I didn't play it at the time at all. So I'm sort of going slightly back to the origin story, before I picked up my Dreamcast in probably 98, I imagine, 97, 98, I picked up a PlayStation 1 because we hadn't had a console for a few years. And me and my brother got Resident Evil 2 with it. So it was mostly 98. And we got Resident Evil 2 and we came home, put it on. And I was severely unimpressed. We were PC gamers at the time, both of us. And I think it just didn't do it for me at all. So I never really liked Resident Evil games at all. I haven't really played them until probably, I think I touched on 4. And then when I started playing Dreamcast games, obviously in the last 10 years, Code Veronica, I've been playing. I have completed Code Veronica on Dreamcast. Mm. It's good. I still don't really get, I don't get it. Maybe I would get it more if I was into it at the time. But the static screen, it's better looking than Resident Evil 2 and 3. But to me, it's not my sort of game.
That's fair. It's not everybody's cup of tea, I suppose. Lewis, coming to things later on. Obviously, you didn't play at the time. If you did when you were seven, then your parents were really awful. What did you think about it later on? Have you played it? I'm guessing you have.
I do own the game. I didn't really play it through really on my own. It sounded like I was really scared of it or something. No, but my cousin played it. You know, like we had a thing where like me and him would take turns on games and we'd play through them together, because, you know, certain games, like especially these ones with puzzles, like sometimes, like, you know, it's quite nice to have someone like who's playing it with you and you can kind of like figure out the, you know, the puzzles together. So, you know, I played a bit of it and mostly he took control, because I'm so terrible at some of these puzzles in some of these games. And I thought it was really cool. Unfortunately, it was quite a while ago, so I don't really have really a great memory of it. But, you know, it's definitely one of the more unique of the old style, I suppose you could put in quotes, Resident Evil games. So I definitely want to give it a go at some point. Yeah, surprisingly, considering I was the host of the horror episode we did, I've not played as many of the sort of older Resident Evils. It was mainly 4 on the GameCube that really kind of hooked me. So yeah.
One thing I'd like to add on Code Veronica specifically as well is that, you know, you look at the original Resident Evil games and you mentioned it, Andrew, that a big part of what went into the atmosphere of those games and the kind of the shock effect and the tension that they had was the fixed camera angles. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a real testament to Code Veronica that it doesn't lose any of that with also having a free moving camera. I think it's you know, it's really impressive that it didn't lose that kind of that fear effect. And also, obviously, you know, we were kind of used to these very, very fuzzy but very detailed pre-rendered backgrounds, because obviously they were pre-rendered, whereas obviously in this one it's all 3D polygons. And I think it's again, it's impressive they made such an immersive environment without relying on these kind of these images stitched together.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, something always interesting when Resident Evil comes up is so many people have such a positive and such a great love from Resident Evil games going back to the day. I think it's very similar in my mind to GoldenEye on the N64, where these two games that an entire sector of gamers at that time, and I'm talking about PC gamers, they struggle to have those same memories, because what was on the PC at that time was so next level in terms of what it was doing. Mm. I think it's very difficult for me, for instance. I could never get the static screen on Resident Evil. To me, it never worked for me. I could never really understand why that was great when I could go and play System Shock 2 on a PC and have an experience which was better. So I think you had to really be there for Resident Evil games. I know a lot of people, quite recently there's been a bit of a thing where some people were saying that they didn't like Resident Evil games, and people were saying how, you know, as the internet does, they weren't real gamers and all this kind of nonsense. But I think it's just literally the last game I can think of, really, where the last sort of genre where you had to really be there to understand why it was so atmospheric and so good at the time. And if you didn't, and if you were used to other things at the time, it maybe doesn't have quite the appeal. That goes for all survival horror games, really. It's not only Resident Evil. Resident Evil 4, obviously, is an amazing game, and that's a segue. I'll stop there.
Yeah, I think there's, Resident Evil 4 kind of, it was more of a, it felt like more of a mass appeal game, whereas the Resident Evil games were very niche, and they appealed to a very particular, you know, the horror fan, whereas Resident Evil 4 could appeal to action gamers.
Can we call them niche? I mean, they were one of the highest selling games on the PlayStation. They're not niche, are they, really?
I suppose that's true. I guess in terms of the fact that Resident Evil 4 was, like, absolutely humongous compared to the others, I suppose, then, I don't know.
I think niche with gamers are different, isn't it? Because something like Final Fantasy VII, the sort of what it is, it's a niche sort of game, but it wasn't at the time. I think that goes for a lot of stuff. Looks like Doom, when it first came out, wasn't massive selling the very first couple of months. It was only after a while that it became.
I think the genre was niche, though, and I think that's the big difference. Is when Resident Evil came out, I know you had like Alone in the Dark before it, but there was, other than that, it was a very niche genre. There was not a lot of people doing it. Whereas, you know, yes, Resident Evil 4 is a Resident Evil game, but you know, it's still very action oriented rather than the kind of creeping around, scaring yourself shitless atmosphere that you get from the originals.
And the thing about Code Veronica as well is that it was a huge thing for the Dreamcast. It was this big proven franchise that had been huge on the PlayStation. It, like you say, Mike, had sold really well, even if the horror franchise, you know, the horror genre itself was fairly niche at the time. It broke through, I suppose, to the mainstream with Resident Evil, I guess. Code Veronica then was a huge coup for Sega to get for the Dreamcast. And what strikes me as well is we talk about pre-rendered backgrounds and then the transformation to 3D with Code Veronica is how close together. I mean, Resident Evil 3 came out months before Code Veronica did, so it's quite almost a shock to see them side by side. You see Resident Evil 3 and then you see Code Veronica, which, you know, it was the same year, I think, that it released in Europe anyway. And yes, the difference is amazing, and it was definitely a huge coup for Sega. And possibly one of the biggest non-Sega games that there was. I don't know if anybody else would agree on the Dreamcast. It's one of the biggest ones.
I think it regularly comes, doesn't it? I think it regularly comes.
Yes. First. Yeah. Sales-wise, I know it's up there as one of the best sellers on the console. I think it was one of the only ones that went over a million from memory.
And of course, we also had, of course, in Japan, they had the improved version in Japan as well. Is it Code Veronica X?
Yes,
Biohazard, right. Obviously. Biohazard, Code Veronica X, which is worth looking at, actually. I did go through that when I was doing the guide, and it's quite impressive what they've done.
Mm. Yeah, and that's the version that they ported then to everything else, wasn't it? Yeah. So that's the one you get on the PS2, on you can get it for the PS4 now even, I think. So yeah, it's a big game, but it's one of those games now that you wouldn't think was big because all the Resident Evil games that came since were bigger, I suppose. So it's almost got lost in modern gaming as compared to Resident Evil 4, which has kind of overshadowed everything. I mean, talking of other Resident Evil games, I guess we can mention briefly, there was two others on the Dreamcast. There was Resident Evil 3, which I just mentioned, Nemesis, which came out the year after Code Veronica, but the same year technically as Code Veronica, but on the PlayStation. And then you had the port of Resident Evil 2 as well. Those who've played those two, how do you think they stood up on the Dreamcast as ports?
I've never played 3 on anything, which is only Resident Evil game I've never played, and I was going to go back to it until they announced the remakes. I'm just planning on going into the remake completely fresh. But 2 was great. I thought 2 maybe not the best port, and again, it was at the time where we were kind of fixated on Code Veronica, but I had 2 on the PlayStation and never finished it, so it was just, I think I rented it on the Dreamcast just to see if they made it look massively better. I was never as hot on Resident Evil 2 as other people did, so it doesn't have the same kind of, I know most people rave about 2, saying it's better than 1, whereas I always preferred 1, because I preferred the that claustrophobia feeling you had from being in the mansion rather than being out in the open. But yeah, I remember thinking it wasn't a massively impressive port at the time, but it's still an amazing game.
Am I right in thinking they ported them both from the PC versions? PC, is that right?
Yeah.
I think Resident Evil 3 had additional costumes and stuff that they had on the PC. I think you could dress Jill up in the costume for Regina from Dino Crisis, I believe. There was all sorts of little extras that you didn't get in the PlayStation version, which was quite cool, I thought, at the time. And then it was those versions, 2 and 3, that they then ported onto the GameCube. Best versions, I think. The best versions of the game was Dreamcast and GameCube had the best versions of 2 and 3, just purely down to the fact that there's higher quality of textures, the extra stuff that they added in, just the better ones.
A brief aside, but I remember the N64 version of Resident 2 getting massive praise for how they managed to port that over without losing anything in the way of, or without losing too much in the way of quality on the both the pre-rendered backgrounds and the cutscenes and stuff. That's really interesting, because obviously it came on 2 discs, and they managed to squeeze it down into a single I think it was 64 meg card. It could have been a bigger one, but I think it was 64. But super impressive.
Was that the one that had like a randomized mode where like the different items would appear in different places to, on every single playthrough? I swear that was a thing, because I remember seeing a clip of like a video about it. It sounded really cool.
Yeah, it's it. I don't know which game it is, but it is a feature of one of them. Yes,
it does sound cool actually. So there was a lot of in-engine cutscenes, as I remember, but didn't they have to put those into video files to actually fit them in somehow, or was it the way around? I can't remember which way it was.
I think it was just all I know is there was a lot of heavily compressed FMVs, but which still looked reasonably well, which is obviously never a strong point with the N64, but either way, to cram it all in was pretty impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, just briefly touching on those, because they are on the Dreamcast, but they probably, you know, don't really hold a candle to Code Veronica, which is the kind of jewel and the crown of the survival horror for Capcom. The other survival horror game that Capcom released on the Dreamcast, and it's another port, was the is another totally 3D survival horror game. The one kind of came before Code Veronica, kind of set the scene for, I suppose, was Dino Crisis. Mm-hmm. Again, I think a port from the PC version, yeah. I believe. That one came, I can't remember exactly when it released. I think it was 2000, I believe, early 2000. So, yeah. Personally, I love this game. I didn't love it when I first played it on the PlayStation. I actually wanted to take it back within an hour of playing it, because I thought it was so unlike Resident Evil, which I'd kind of been led to believe it was very much like, that I was very put off by it. But I gave it a chance and ultimately fell in love with it. And the Dreamcast version is the ultimate version, really. It's the best textures. It looks the nicest. Has anybody else played this one?
Yes, I have. I don't have much to say about it, really. It's. I think I played the PC version at the time. I have a brief memory of me playing the PC version. It's another one of these games where, I suppose, it's depending on what you had at the time. It was a PlayStation 1 game originally, wasn't it?
That's right.
I think again, I was never really into that sort of thing. Playing it now, though, it's. I thought I came to it very much same as like you did. I was told it was Resident Evil with dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. It's not really at all. Although it's quite fun to say that and piss people off, but it's got. I think it's got that sort of the vibe of the kitchen in Jurassic Park to me.
Yeah,
sort of vibe, which is, you know, it's a standard thing for most of our childhood. So for that alone, it's good. But as a game, I just didn't think it really did much. I think maybe Resident Evil did set a really high bar for survival horror, and I think everything really struggled in comparison.
It was definitely different from Resident Evil, and it probably, like you say, it did suffer for that. But I think if you could look past that, if you could go to it fresh without the connotations of Resident Evil being attached to it, I think there's definitely something to enjoy there. And there's the rumors going around at the moment that the next remake that Capcom are possibly going to do is a Dino Crisis one, so that might be an interesting one to look out for. But in the meantime, it's available on the Dreamcast, since you're listening to DreamPod. Go pick it up, potentially. I guess let's move on. Those are the only survival horror games that Capcom did for the Dreamcast. The next category that we're going to look at actually is the most type of games that Capcom released for the Dreamcast. Kind of unsurprisingly, really, as Capcom's kind of known for this type of game, this genre, and that would be fighting games. So there are bloody loads. hang on, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. There's 16 that I'm counting here. It looks like a couple of them are kind of variations on the same game. But I guess I'm going to start at the top of this list. And there are three games that we're going to bundle all together just to discuss, which is Capcom versus SNK, Capcom versus SNK Millennium Fight 2000 Pro, and Capcom versus SNK 2. The first thing I want to ask is, what is the difference between the first game and Millennium Fight 2000 Pro? Does anybody know?
From what I remember, it's an updated Japanese-only version.
Right.
Which has online play. I'm going to say online play and then be told by someone I'm wrong. So I'm going to very quickly look up my own review. it's got two new modes, two new characters, an update, basically. I think it was probably an arcade update in the arcades first, and then they updated that to the Dreamcast version.
Right, okay. Cool. Yeah. There was a lot of that on the Dreamcast, wasn't there? There was a lot of kind of updates of games. If I remember rightly, you'd got the game, and then in Japan, you'd get an updated version. It was almost like the patch that we get now.
I think the thing is, the 16 games that we've listed on the fighting games that we're going for, actually, there's probably about another 10 versions of those games that were then re-released. So we've got a lot of... we'll go over them in a bit, I'm sure, but there's lots of other versions as well. So if you're actually looking at different versions of fighting games on Dreamcast for Capcom, you're probably looking at about 25, 26.
Wow. I mean, with these ones in particular, then, the Capcom versus SNK games, is anybody a particular fan of these ones? Is it their cup of tea?
Yeah, I love them. Yeah, fantastic games.
When it comes to fighting games, I really enjoy them now, and I do get into them quite a bit, but I didn't back in the day. But I was always fascinated by crossovers, and I always loved seeing like the different rosters and the different, the different sort of characters from series you know elsewhere, whether that's a fighting game or something else. So I always kind of enjoyed. I've never played these games, but always enjoyed kind of looking through the screenshots and stuff of these to try and pick out various characters from different games.
Yeah, the thing with that is I'm not big, but I love SNK fighters. So I like the King of Fighters games a lot more than I do Street Fighter games. So these kind of games are really good to me. The first one of these, Capcom vs SNK, is a lot more in the style of SNK fighters, and so I really enjoy that. Capcom vs SNK 2, which is the highly regarded game, is a Capcom style, so it's more of a Street Fighting style fight. But they're both just great. So there's so many good fighting characters from both developers.
I've only played the second one. I'm pretty terrible at these kind of sort of side-on 2D fighting games, but I really do appreciate the legacy of what both Capcom and SNK have built over the years. Like, I really love their characters, and I have given them a go. They're good to play with friends. I usually get thrashed at them, but you know, it was pretty cool to see them together in this one game. And I always loved the sort of subtitle. I don't know if it was the PlayStation version, but that whole, you know, match of the millennium, like, it felt like this like really big deal, which it was, because obviously it's these two massive companies coming together. The only thing I think I thought when I played it was that it would have been really cool if they'd have put characters in that we wouldn't have expected, like the characters from like Metal Slug or something, just random like that. So yeah, I really liked it though. And I discovered a lot of like cool characters I'd never heard of. And you know, when I've gone to arcades and played other, you know, SNK games, you know, I know them now because I played them in these crossovers.
The way you were talking about the difference between the two versions, SNK 1 and 2, it reminds me of what Capcom did later on, which was when they did Street Fighter versus Tekken, because they did two versions, didn't they? They did Street Fighter versus Tekken, and then Tekken versus Street Fighter, I think. And each one was basically the style of either a Street Fighter or a Tekken, but with both characters from both games in it. So it seems like they kind of did the same thing they did with Capcom versus SNK.
They actually did the same with Capcom versus SNK, because I'm pretty sure, I don't know if there's one on Neo Geo itself, but on the Neo Geo Pocket Color, there is an SNK versus Capcom games. SNK developed those, whilst Capcom developed the ones on Dreamcast or other consoles.
Quite a good idea, really, isn't it? Because then you get to do, you know, you get to have the fighting style of each game, but you know, with the characters you want, and you can just pick which version you want, I suppose, which is, you know, which fighter you prefer. So that's quite cool.
Just a random aside, because I feel like I'll never have a chance to mention this again. There was also a Neo Geo Pocket Color game called Capcom and SNK of Card Fighters Clash that did the same, where there was like two versions, and it's like this random sort of Yu-Gi-Oh! Pokemon card game, but with all these different characters from these games. It has like Power Stone characters as the cards. that was really fun. So if you ever see that, check it out.
And of course, whilst you're getting that, you also pick up the SNK versus Capcom game on the Neo Geo Color, because it does link up with the first Capcom versus SNK game as well. So if you have the Neo Geo Pocket Link cable, you can actually link it up. It's one of the, I think it's five or six games that link up on Dreamcast.
Hey, do you know what you get for doing that, Mike, at all?
I think it's extra characters and extra outfits. I don't actually own the Neo Geo Pocket Color game. I do have the Neo Geo Pocket Color game with some other games that released, but not that one.
Just before the millions of fans write in, Street Fighter versus Tekken did come out. Tekken versus Street Fighter never did come out in the end. It was due to come out in 2012, I think, or something like that. But yeah, as far as I know, never ever actually saw the light of day.
Did the first one just not sell well enough to bother making the other one, or?
I have no idea.
I remember there being a bit of a controversy, but I doubt that would have set them back from releasing the second one, you know.
But it's still, I mean, it's a good idea. It's something that would be good to have today, even. Those kind of crossover. We haven't seen, apart from the Marvel versus Capcom series, which kind of continues, we don't really see those crossovers anymore, which is a shame. And also, you really made me want to buy a Neo Geo Pocket Color. I can't afford one, but... yeah, if there's a game that has Power Stone characters in, sign me up.
There's two, to be fair, so it's maybe not worth the money.
You've sold me now, just stop talking. The next one, I'm going down in alphabetical order here. So we're going to go to JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, which, to be perfectly honest, is a game that I don't know much about, apart from the fact that it looks very colourful and exciting. It's another 2D fighter. Can anybody kind of shed some light on JoJo's Bizarre Adventure?
It's going to be me again, isn't it?
Are you going to tell us that there's two versions of it?
There are two versions of it, actually, yeah. But and I know that because of the fact I've actually got one, the other version on the way to me now. But there's one of the versions is a Film Action Service version, which I'll go through in a bit. But JoJo's Bizarre Adventure is based on two arcade games, I believe. I think it's a compilation of two arcade games, both based on the very popular... manga anime of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. It's not anime, it's a manga, I think. I haven't watched the actual series, if there is a series, and I haven't read the books, if there are books. But it's a very popular, and obviously I think there's a same titled game released a couple of years ago on a PS4 as well, if I remember rightly.
I think so, yeah.
It's a really good game. It's a 2D, very much like, as you'd imagine, Capcom to produce. And the big thing is you have Dinkle Stands, which are the sort of characters. I'm going to class them as soul characters for each character in the game. It's a really bad description. I haven't played the game for quite a while, so anyone listening to this who wants to write and complain, feel free. I know Patrick from the Saturn podcast will hate me saying things on right about JoJo, but it's a really good game. It's quite a fun game. It's not really, unless you know the source material, it's going to be go over your head a little bit. One thing I would say as well, if you play it on a VGA cable, I believe it's VGA cable, it comes out really weird on a PAL TV. It goes into a tiny little box. Every time I've played it, it's done the same thing. So I'm guessing it's a problem with this one. Some Capcom games do have the same problem where it's not been quite optimized for VGA. But to be honest with you, with these kind of games, you probably want to play on a CRT anyway if you can, because that's how these games were designed.
Very true.
I knew this existed because of the anime, and
it is an anime, is it?
Yeah, it's both manga and anime. I was kind of shocked to see it was a sort of a 2D fighter. I kind of expected to look up footage and it be, you know, a cel shaded 3D brawler or something, you know. And probably any more recent games probably have followed that style. But yeah, I didn't know if it was one that's probably really just for like the core audience, because not to sort of undermine its quality or anything, to me it looked quite similar to other games from Capcom on this system. So I didn't know if perhaps it's more just for the JoJo fans.
My experience of this is the same as Andrew's. I think I vividly remember the PAL box, seeing it on a shelf, not knowing anything about the game or the manga, and thinking that looks really cool, picking it up thinking it would be some sort of platformer or adventure game or something, and then turning the box around and it was a beat 'em up, a 2D beat 'em up, which I promptly put back on the shelf. But I just remember the box art. It's quite striking, and it's not very beat 'em up ish from if that's a thing.
I'm surprised actually if it sold that much at all, because I mean, I'm sure there were fans around, but like, I feel that the big cult following that this anime has kind of garnered has been fairly recent. I don't know, maybe someone's going to like, you know, tell me off for this.
There's a couple of games, isn't there, which have these sort of weird, if it wasn't a PlayStation release, no one would, I think it is a PlayStation release as well, actually.
It is, yeah.
No one would particularly notice because there's loads of these ones, but on Dreamcast they stand out. So you've got Sword of the Berserk as well, where, you know, for most people in the UK or for Europe, they're not going to know what Berserk is. So it's a couple of little sort of random record of Lodoss War as well, I suppose. Same thing, based on a manga. So it's a couple of weird ones like that.
Okay. I feel like we've got so many fighting games to talk about. So, I mean, there's the big standout ones. So let's. I'm going to move on to another crossover. There were two games, one of which is hugely regarded. And I know for a long time, it was probably one of the priciest games on the Dreamcast. Probably not so much now that it's been ported everywhere. And those are Marvel vs. Capcom and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Again, I mean, I've never been a huge 2D fighting fan particularly. I remember that I did enjoy Marvel vs. Capcom 2 a little bit. I think I did have it for a little while and I enjoyed it because it had Jill Valentine from Resident Evil in it, and that on its own was awesome. But yeah, I didn't really stick with me. Is anybody else a particular fan of this particular franchise?
it's a fantastic games. If you're a fan of Capcom fighting games and a fan of Marvel, I think it's the perfect mix. I actually like the first one better than the second one. I think the second one sort of loses some of its... It's crazy. The second one is just literally... It's just absolutely over the top at times. The first one's really good fighting game. The newer ones are good as well, actually. I enjoy them as well. But they're really good games. I mean, there's a lot of fan service in them. Yeah. A huge amount of fan service.
Yeah. Definitely is proven by the Resident Evil characters in it, which is the only thing that really drew me in. And this is really before Marvel became the hot property as well. This is way before the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So it's, I mean, they're obviously still big in the comic world, but it's a gamble that's paid off for Capcom, I guess, now, because they've got this huge franchise that they can kind of market with, I suppose. Although that didn't do them much good with Marvel versus Capcom Infinite, if I remember rightly. I don't think that sold very well.
No.
Marvel versus Capcom is actually one of the coolest gifts I've ever received for a Secret Santa.
Oh, wow.
When I was at uni, obviously, I bored everyone to tears, like, the Dreamcast is great, da-da-da-da. And we were talking about, someone was like, oh, you know, Marvel versus Capcom was great, I remember that. And I was like, oh, you know, I don't actually own that one. And this was at the time when, like, sealed Dreamcast games were quite cheap on eBay, well, certain ones, and they got me this for a Secret Santa gift, whoever that was. So yeah, that's kind of a random thing to just randomly get in a Secret Santa.
That is pretty awesome. That's a good Secret Santa present. Yeah. People should do Secret Santa more often. that'd be a lot of fun. We did that on the Switch Island and that was brilliant. So maybe we do a Dreamcast Junkyard Secret Santa.
If we do a Dreamcast Junkyard, I'm giving over, I get Spirit of Speed 1937, I'm telling you that now.
I don't have a copy of that, so go for it.
No, neither do I, actually, although it sounds like we should probably just kind of pretend to Mike that we're not doing a Secret Santa. anyway.
For the best.
Moving on. One that I'm not familiar with particularly, but I know a little bit about because of the book, is Plasma Sword, which is also Star Gladiator 2. And the only reason I know about this is because Star Gladiator, the original, was I think it was Capcom's first proper 3D fighting game. Mm-hmm. And so the sequel, Plasma Sword, came to the Dreamcast. Did this come to the PlayStation 1 as well, am I thinking? Right, Plasma Sword, or was that a Dreamcast exclusive?
I think it's a Dreamcast exclusive, I think.
Yeah, it got Star Gladiator. PS1 got Star Gladiator, the first one. So yeah, Dreamcast exclusive sequel to what I believe, and somebody's going to correct me now on the internet, what I believe was Capcom's first 3D fighting game. What's this one like? Who's played it? Who's enjoyed it? Does anybody hate it? What's the thoughts?
It's a pretty forgettable game, unfortunately, really? Which is probably why we're not talking about it much. It's left behind by Capcom's other games. I think it's not as good a 3D fighter as Soul Calibur and Dead or Alive 2, and it's not as good a 2D fighter as pretty much every other Marvel, pretty much every other Capcom game.
Fair enough. So not a huge amount to say about it then, really.
I mean, I found out about it the other day. I was browsing eBay because obviously being on this podcast has really energized my collector passion again for the Dreamcast, and that came up on a bid, and I was like, oh, what's this, you know, maybe I should have a look at it. And you know, I looked up footage for this episode, and like Mike said, it didn't really stand out to me. It just kind of looked like, you know,
it's not a bad game, it's just why would you buy it when there's better ones out there?
True. All right, let's move on to something that I know that a couple of us, maybe all of us even, could wax lyrical about for quite a while. And those are the Power Stone games, Power Stone 1, Power Stone 2. Very different from Capcom's other fighting games in that they're completely 3D, as in on all three axes. You can move wherever you like within the stage. You're not bound by the other person, the opponent. Really, really odd game. Odd in a great way, kind of left field for a fighting game. What are people's thoughts about these particular games?
I thought Power Stone was amazing. As I said, I think there's probably a bit of rose-tinted glasses here because it was the first game I actually played on a Dreamcast. But I think just the whole, it was an assault on the eyes, on the ears. It was so arcadey. You had that, you know, the sound effects were really bassy, and it was just, it was so different from anything I'd personally played up until that point. As I said, I was never a massive fighting game fan, but obviously, like most people my age, had played quite a lot of Street Fighter 2 and Mortal Kombat growing up. So that was kind of my reference for fighting games. So to go from that to this, as you said, this completely sort of 3D open space where you could interact with objects, throw things at each other, and just generally sort of, you know, run and jump about. It was, I just thought it was amazing. And it was a game that I previously probably wouldn't have looked twice at, but after playing it, it went straight on my list of games that I eventually wanted to pick up, which I then did when the UK Dreamcast came out, you know, a few months after launch.
Nice. Anybody else got fond memories of these particular ones?
Power Stone 2 is the main one I remember. I do remember playing Power Stone 1 when I was younger as well. And I think it might be just one of those games that almost in a way it's a fighter, but it's not kind of like a proper traditional fighter, like maybe Street Fighter or something. It in a way, it's like something like Smash Brothers, where I think anyone could probably pick up a controller and really do fairly well on it. It's one of those games where, you know, when people come around to my house and we play Dreamcast, everyone, you know, they're like, oh, what are the buttons? And then, you know, two fights in and they're like kicking my ass at it. So, yeah, it's a really good one to get into, a lot of fun, even though it's like not many levels. The gameplay can vary quite a lot, you know, depending on the item drops and whatnot. Yeah, Power Stone 1. Sadly, my Dreamcast crashes. There's this whole thing that some Dreamcasts, you know, there'll be certain games that they crash or they don't work properly, and that's Power Stone, unfortunately, is one of them. So I can't actually get it past, you know, like the fourth stage or something. It just hangs on the loading screen. But I have played it on the PSP collection, so I played it all the way to the end. I beat the final boss. But Power Stone 2 is the main kind of game that I absolutely adore. It's probably in my top five favorite games of all time. It's just so much fun, and it's one of the few games I've actually played all the way through and unlocked all the levels and the fighters. And I just love the way that the game kind of moves around you in number two, like the way that you'll be on, like, you know, the airship, and then it'll explode, and then you're all flying through the sky, and then you crash down, you know, but you lose health if you didn't grab an umbrella while you were floating through the sky. So, like, it's just so dynamic, you know, running away from the boulder and whatnot. So, yeah, it's an absolutely amazing game. I could go on for hours, but I'm going to let someone else speak.
I have to do a Power Stone dedicated podcast just to get all those thoughts out. Mike, if you had to pick between one and two, which would you pick?
I think two. I think two is it's more of a party game for me. So it's kind of a game I put on at the same time as Mario Party. That sort of game where everyone can enjoy, everyone can sort of have fun with. So I think number two for that. But I think in terms of an actual game for a single player, I think number one.
They both bring something quite different, don't they? And it's,
yeah,
what you were talking about, Marvel versus Capcom 2 being a bit flashier and being a bit more over the top, and that's what Power Stone 2 is. It's almost like the same kind of thing. Power Stone 1's more of a, it feels like a polished fighting game, and then Power Stone 2 feels very over the top, not in a bad way, it just, it's very brash and over the top for me. So I would always prefer 1 personally, but yeah. I haven't asked you yet, James, if you had to pick between one and two, which would you pick?
One all day. I think I agree with you. It was more of the single player experience for one. And as I said, I from a nostalgic point of view, I'm always going to pick one for that exact reason.
All right, let's move on down this ginormous list of fighting games. So many. The next one is a game that I've played and loved so much because it was bloody bizarre. I mean, this was one where you had a guy in a swimming hat and speedos kind of swimming through imaginary water as he kind of took out his opponent. And this, if anybody doesn't know just from that description, is Project Justice Rival Schools 2. I won't even try and say the Japanese name next to it because I'll just mess it up. Mike, thoughts on this one?
Great game. I love Project Justice. It's a fantastic game. It's very Japanese in its style, all based around high schools. And it's just got this really sort of, it's got a really clean look to it, which is really difficult to describe. Mm-hmm. But it's got a really clean anime look to the game, which really appeals to me. And it's just, it's a really good fighting game as well. It's not as good a fighting game, if we're being technical, probably, than some of the other Capcom games. Mm. But it's a really fun game. And, of course, the Japanese version is even better because it's got a full board game-style mode in the game, which was taken out of the PAL version.
Oh, I did not know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's a really weird. I think I can't remember actually what happens in the game now, but it's like a sort of board games based around the schools and based around the environments. Mm. But there's lots of text, I think, they took out for that reason.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I was going to say, is it playable to an English-speaking person? But no, probably not. And it's very, for the PAL version is expensive to get now, which for me is annoying because I sold my PAL copy back when I needed money and really, really wish I hadn't because it's one game that I'd love to play again. That's in the realms of £60-70 now, if I'm not mistaken, I believe.
A lot of Capcom games are really expensive. Project Justice is up there, £100-ish now at the current time.
This is one, there's a few games like this where at that time during college, I looked it up and I was like, yeah, you know, I'd quite like to get that. And obviously now, I regret not just, I think it was probably about £40 back then. And that was like, oh, that's too expensive for me. I can't get that. The main reason, it's kind of weird, the main reason I was always attracted to this, because there's a band called Rival Schools and they're named after the game. And even more so, their first album is called United by Fate, which was the subtitle for the first game. So there's a bit of random music trivia for you. But yeah, I like them. I was like, oh, they're named after this game, and there's a sequel on the Dreamcast. Stuff like that makes me interested in things, I guess. But yeah, it looks really cool. I love the kind of overly Japanese kind of look to it, and that kind of thing interests me. So yeah, I would pick it up if I could. Mike, do you know if the Japanese version is cheap at all, or is it expensive as the PAL version?
It's cheaper. It's about 40, I think. I think it's the Japanese about 40. PAL version's around probably 80 to 100. And I think the American version's about 150. It's a bit expensive, the American version.
Oh, wow. Okay. I may just pick up the Japanese version. Yeah.
Yeah. I need to pick up a new copy for the next book. So, yeah, sounds like Japanese version is the way to go just to play the actual game. But and it's Dreamcast exclusive, isn't it? It's never come out on anything else. So
I believe so, yeah.
Hence the price, I guess. All right, there's a lot of Street Fighter games here. So for the sake of time, rather than go through all of them, I think the most popular out of the ones on the Dreamcast was probably Street Fighter 3 Third Strike. I'd be right in saying. What are our thoughts on that particular game?
Yeah, it's a great game. Probably the best Street Fighter 2D game. I'm not including Street Fighter 4 onwards. Really good. Still played today by a lot of people. Still held really high. Obviously, it's the final updated version of Street Fighter 3, Double Impact came before, and yeah, it's a good game. It's a great game. If you like Street Fighter, it's a great game. I don't like it that much personally because the character roster to me seems a little bit shaky. But I'm not the target audience, to be honest with you. Fighting game fans swear by it, so I will defer to their knowledge.
This was another rental for me back in the day. Can never go wrong with Street Fighter, and I think my mate was staying over, and we just wanted something to play for the evening, and just rented this, and just came through it. Yeah, it's a Street Fighter game, which I know people will crucify me for, who know the minute differences between them all. But yeah, looked lovely from memory, beautiful colours and everything. But it's a Street Fighter on Dreamcast, happy days.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were a few. I'm just going to read out the names of the Street Fighter games. We won't go through all of them. So we had Third Strike. We also had, as you said, Mike, Street Fighter 3 Double Impact, which came before that. We also had Street Fighter Alpha 3/03.
I remember there being a demo of Alpha 3 that I played quite a bit on one of the Dream On demo discs. I think that was Alpha 3. But yeah, I remember playing the demo of it a lot. So a lot of Ken versus Ryu, probably.
Nice. Worth noting, EX or X, however we pronounce it, didn't come out on the Dreamcast. That's not one on the Dreamcast. The other one that was on the Dreamcast was Super Street Fighter 2 X for matching service. Mike, this is where you explain to us what the heck is matching service.
So for matching service, from what I remember, is a online Japanese possibly subscription service by Capcom. Mm-hmm. They released lots of their games with the matching service availability, which also meant basically you could play their fighting games online. Several of the Street Fighter games, I think Street Fighter 2 plus also Third Strike had one as well. Possibly Zero Three had one. I know Zero Three had one. A couple of other games had them as well. Mostly fighting games, and there's one which is not a fighting game, which we'll touch on later on, but it's mostly fighting games, and it's allowed you to play online, which obviously in Japan was huge, because fighting games in Japan were a huge, huge phenomenon.
Two more fighting games to go, and I don't know a huge amount. We've got Tecromancer, which I've seen a lot of. I think this is one, when I go on eBay to look at Dreamcast games, I'll come across it and I'll be like, ah, interesting, but never actually take the plunge. Is this one worth getting? Or
it's a fantastic game. Tecromancer is a fantastic game. It's for people who like Japanese culture, Japanese anime, Japanese manga. It's a definite choice to get. Just for the way it's presented, each sort of bit is presented as a different episode of the series. There's loads of in-between bits. The fighting's quite simple compared to some Capcom games, but it's a really fun, big robot, over-the-top action.
I want to add that despite us having a kind of crap cover in PAL territories, the Japanese cover is amazing. Yeah. It's probably one of the best Japanese cover arts I've seen on any Dreamcast game. For context, I think it's basically, it shows like the mech's head and then like the pilot kind of standing on the little bridge to go into it, you know, to pilot it. It's really cool. Check it out if you haven't seen it.
It's pretty cool. Well, on that recommendation, I'm going to have to get this game at some point now just to play it. I didn't realize it was even any good. It always looked a bit... It reminded me... It seemed like it was going to be similar to Plasma Sword. So I was kind of like, okay, fair enough. Fair enough. The last fighting game on here is another full matching service game, which is Vampire Chronicle full matching service. So Vampire Chronicle is a 2D game. I can't remember which console it originally came out on. Was it PlayStation?
Saturn,
that's right. And so this was a version they ported to the Dreamcast for this matching service Japanese subscription thing. Is that right?
It's a compilation. So it's a compilation of Vampire Savior and Vampire Hunter.
Ah, okay.
And so we're better known in the UK as Darkstalkers. It's that series in Japan. It was my pick for Halloween game, I believe, or horror game. I absolutely love Vampire Chronicle. It's a fantastic game. If you've got the Saturn versions, there pretty much isn't any need to get the Dreamcast version. It's the exact same games. But if you haven't got the Saturn versions, then it's a fantastic game to get.
Nice. Just to clarify as well, so these four matching service games, if you were going to try and buy one, are these games that are playable without an internet connection?
Oh, yes.
It's a full game, right?
Yeah. Full games just have the online options as well. I don't think there's any way of getting it back online again. James is probably a better person to talk to than I am about that. So I don't think it's going to be in the future. I don't expect to get it and sort of be able to play online in the future. But, okay. I mean, it would be amazing if we could. Mm.
Were these like running on like specific like Capcom servers that would need to be around in order to play it, I guess, or
I think so. I think the matching service, I think, meant that it would match you with opponents of the same skill level as you. So I think that's possibly why, or something along those lines. I don't think the structures are able to play them anymore, unfortunately.
That's quite clever, actually, then, for the Dreamcast era. That's quite an interesting thing that they had. This kind of standard now, I guess, but even back in kind of PS2, PS3, that was kind of a novel thing to be matched with somebody of the same skill set as you in fighting games. So for them to have that in the Dreamcast era in Japan is pretty cool, actually. All right, moving on. Let's talk about shmups, as we've got it written up, shmups, and we've got four of them. We're going to go through them. Now, there's two in the same franchise, which is Giga Wing and Giga Wing 2. Now, I'm going to say straight up, I don't play shmups very much, if at all. So I've not played any of these. So I'm going to rely on you guys to tell me all about them. Giga Wing and the sequel, what do we think?
So Giga Wing, as with most Capcom shooters, it's a Takumi game. So it's not developed by Capcom as such. Really good game. I love Giga Wing 1 and 2. Very, very basic if you don't like shooters. There's not much more than just shooting. But it's absolutely crazy. Giga Wing 2 is one of the greatest games you'll ever see. I think there's a four-player option on Giga Wing 2. Anyone who actually had a chance to play a four-wing Giga Wing 2 would probably blow your mind, because it's just it's a bullet hell game. I don't think it actually is a bullet hell game. I got in trouble last time I said this because someone said that's not what a bullet hell game is. I don't know. There's lots of bullets on screen. It feels like hell playing it sometimes. Bullet hell game. So it's just pixels everywhere. There's things going around. It's absolutely manic. Really good fun, and has the best theme music for the first level of Giga Wing 1 ever made.
Is that the one that you featured in our
radio? I did.
Yeah, the Radio Sega episode. See, I'm plugging all the different episodes we've done. This is how we get that. Oh, I was going to say internet money, but you know, we're not making any money. It's all passion. It's all passion.
It's the notoriety we're after, not the money.
Yes.
So, Gunbird 2, is this in a similar vein to Giga Wing, or is it very different? Or
I have this game. I got it from that GameStar shop. I think it's a cool game. You know, a lot of anime characters. I think like the main character on the front is like a witch. Probably stands out a lot more compared to these other shooters we've got on the list for Capcom. Probably because of that reason. I've played it a little bit. I'm not very good at shooters. Like, I'm not very good at many games, apparently. But I remember me and my friend sitting down, and we went through it together, because you can basically just keep continuing without any consequence. So me and him just sat there and just went through the whole thing. I think my mind had slightly melted by the end of it. I think we went for a walk afterwards because we needed to rest our brains a bit. Yeah,
I think it's very pleasing on the eyes compared to most shoot 'em ups. I think it's just got a really nice art style to it. I like the way the levels are constructed. I think there's like sort of Wild West styly levels that you go through, and obviously it's not just in the middle of space like most of these sorts of games. And from memory, I've played this quite a bit. From memory, there is, and I know this is quite a trend with these sorts of games, but there was sort of huge bosses that take up like the entire screen when you get to those parts as well. And yeah, I kind of like this one, just because, you like I said, you're not in a ship in space firing at things. There's actually stuff which are visually pleasing and sort of keep your attention for longer than the normal 5 minute go until you've kind of used all your credits that I often get from playing these sorts of games.
To move on then, we've got the next one, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think this one came out in the UK. I think it was, it came out in the US, didn't it? US and Japan, if I remember rightly. And this is Mars Matrix.
Mars Matrix is it's another game by Takumi. So same people who made Giga Wing 1 and 2. So it's same sort of gameplay. It's very, very highly regarded by a lot of people. I know we had Dreamcast Hub. Used to come on our podcast a few years ago now. It was his favourite game of all time, and I know lots of other people agree with him. It scored really highly, and we did the actual voting as well. A few people put it as their number one game. It's a really manic shooter again. The scores are ridiculous, into the sort of like, you know, quadrillions. And then you basically, the more you play, you can unlock stuff in the shop. So it's got a real, almost like Soul Calibur was, in terms of the fact there was a lot more depth than a usual sort of fighting game. Mars Matrix has a lot of depth like that. In terms of the actual style, it's very 2D. It's 16-bit style, I suppose you could say, in how it looks. Doesn't look amazing, but it's got a lot of depth for sure. Also very expensive as well, in both Japanese and American versions.
Yeah. So not one you can just kind of casually pick up and play, but if it's your kind of game, then I suppose you might fork over the money for it.
Only the Dreamcast would allow you to play Burn games.
That's true. But if you're a collector, you know, I suppose.
I don't recommend it.
All right, so next on the list is, as you've turned them here, Mike wrote the list for us, by the way, so I'm going down Mike's list, because of course Mike wrote the list, because, you know, A to Z of Dreamcast games, why would he not? Other shooters is what you've termed these as, and the only two, well, I know all three of them, but the first two, I believe, were ones that came out extremely late on in the Dreamcast life. In fact, I think they both came out in 2002, if I'm remembering rightly, mm-hmm. in Europe at least, is that right?
I think so, yeah. Both were released by Big Ben, weren't they?
I think most games were released by Big Ben at that point, weren't they?
Yeah.
So the first one of these being Cannon Spike / Gun Spike, which I'm guessing Gun Spike was the Japanese title, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I hear this is a great game. I've heard a lot of great things about it, but I actually don't know much about it. Does anybody care to kind of let me know what it's all about?
Top down. I suppose twin stick fighter and a twin stick shooter. It's not a twin stick, obviously, because we haven't got two sticks on a Dreamcast pad. But it's like that. So it's top down. It stars those Capcom characters. So you've got Cammy. You've got Mega Man. You've got Arthur from Ghouls and Ghosts. And it's really short, but it's just really fun. There's loads of difficulty levels, so you can sort of go for the lowest difficulty level. It takes about 15 minutes to complete an entire game. Some people love it, some people hate it. It's quite a Marmite game.
Yeah, I do wonder if it was maybe cheaper and easier to get hold of, at least collector-wise. I sometimes wonder if these expensive games, people say they're amazing because they forked out all the money and they have to sort of stare at it and be like, I have to justify this purchase by liking it. I don't know, maybe.
I think Dreamcast is probably the only console that doesn't happen though. There's, because I think you look at Moho, which is also, this is more expensive than Cannon Spike. I mean, no one has a good word to say about the game at all. I'm not sure if it works Dreamcast because of bird games.
Yeah, to be fair, Cannon Spike, from what I've seen, it looks like a game. Is it multiplayer, Mike? Do you know?
I think so, yeah. I think you can do two player.
Yeah, I probably would like it for that reason then.
All right, moving on. Next one that came out late in the life was Heavy Metal Geomatrix. Again, not one I really know much about. Any particular reason this is a great game, or is it terrible?
So it's very similar to the next game on the list. So Spawn and the Demon's Hand. Mm. It's very similar games. They're arena fighters. They're sort of like small enclosed spaces. Like Power Stone, but nowhere near as good. It's probably the way of doing it. Both based on franchises. Heavy Metal's based on Heavy Metal comic franchise, and Spawn is based on Spawn comic book franchise. They're both very mediocre, personally.
Yeah. I quite like Spawn. I thought Spawn was very Dynamite Cop-esque in certain areas when I played it. I haven't played it a lot, to be fair, but from what I played, it was very arcadey and very kind of had that same sort of feel, you know, run into a room, kick the shit out of people, and then move on. But I didn't mind Spawn, to be honest.
Fair enough. So those are those two, the other shooters. So that was Heavy Metal Geomatrix and Spawn in the Demon's Hand. So the games we've got left, they're kind of like, they're different games to what you probably maybe expect Capcom to do, I suppose. So we'll go through them. We'll kind of briefly mention them, and there might be a couple that we talk in a little bit of detail about. But the first one that we've got here that I want to bring up is, again, just kind of mentioning our WhatsApp group, is one that I think Mike posted something about in the WhatsApp group, and that is Bounty Hunter Sarah, which is an adventure... It's kind of visual novelish game from the video that I saw on YouTube of it. Lots and lots and lots of text, obviously all in Japanese. I mean, is there anything more we can say about this one? It looks interesting, except I wouldn't be able to actually understand what was going on. Mike, is this one you know much about or you've played?
I've played it. I think if you want to get into visual novels on Dreamcast and you're put off by the sort of overly cute Japanese school settings that most of them are set in, Bounty Hunter Sarah is definitely not set like that. It's a very dystopian sort of sci-fi setting, and it's quite cool for that. Unless you have a really good guide or grasp of knowledge of Japanese, you're not going to get very far in it.
This is legitimately the first time I've ever seen this box art and this game. Just googled it now, and that's interesting.
There are so many games in this kind of vein, though, that, like you said, it's different from most visual novels. But they're kind of a dime a dozen on the Dreamcast, and you just don't pay attention to most because there's so many of them.
Yeah.
So interesting to know that it's not quite like the others, which is good.
I had two things about this. One, the box art looks like it belongs on a system before the Dreamcast, you know. And then I was just baffled that a Capcom actually had made a game like this. You know, it's definitely not something they're known for, kind of an adventure visual novel.
I think a lot of developers do a lot more in Japan, though. I think you look at Konami on Dreamcast. Konami did quite a few visual novels, and things like that. So I think it's in Japan where they sell a lot more, it makes more sense. The only thing I would point out from the cover of Bounty Hunter Sarah is it looks like a Blondie album cover.
I was thinking it needs to be on like a Laserdisc or something. That's the sort of year I'm getting from that.
So the next game, again, something a kind of a genre that you don't really associate with Capcom a huge amount, is an RPG. And in fact, they did a 7-volume RPG on the Dreamcast, which was El Dorado Gate. I think it was released. I think they released one every 2 months. Is that right? It was like a
yeah.
So and it was it's a 2D, very JRPG styled game. It was front on battle, wasn't it? So it wasn't like the side on that you'd see in Final Fantasy. It was the enemies were almost first person. Am I thinking correctly?
Possibly.
I believe so, from what I've seen of it. I believe. But this has always intrigued me because the Dreamcast had so few RPGs. So it was always interesting to me that Japan had this series of RPGs that just never made it over here. Obviously, because it was, you know, it was very translation heavy by the looks of things. I mean, I've got a copy of the first one, which I picked up, I think it was last year at, where was it now? It was the Play Expo in Manchester, and I picked up a sealed copy of El Dorado Gate 1, and just the box art is beautiful, and seeing the screenshots of the game is beautiful, but I've never actually played it. Has anybody actually played one of these games? Are they good?
I've played them in terms of, I've had a guide open, and I've played through them. There's a fantastic guide on game facts or game FAQs, and I've actually said that word out loud. Game FAQs is a fantastic guide which is from one person. He's done one for all 7 volumes.
Oh, wow.
Really worth going for it. It's not going to be quite the same as playing it yourself because it's an RPG, so you want to experience some things, but it's worth doing it. It's really, really lovely artwork.
It looks a lot like the game Bastion. That's the the visual. It just reminds me of that one. Just when you watch some gameplay of it, it's really nice to look at.
Absolutely. It's one of those games that, I mean, somebody's done an actual translation for the ROM of Sega Gaga. Is that right? So you can actually download the game with the translation already done for that game, I believe. Is that correct?
Well, that's a touchy subject, Andrew.
Oh,
they stand released the Sega Gaga translation.
But it's been somebody's worked on it.
People have been working on it for a long time,
But El Dorado Gate is one of those that I think somebody should do the same with. I mean, it'd be extremely difficult considering the amount of text there is, I guess. But
I'm not sure whether it would possibly, because the game isn't maybe quite as good as we think it's going to be. I think I don't think the game was ever sort of top tier in Japan. Okay. I think it's sort of that sort of thing where it's a game which was a little bit mystical, a little bit sort of exotic, and has that sort of appeal to us. I think if we had translated versions, it probably wouldn't be quite as good as we would.
So we're fine with it as it is. Let it retain that mystical quality.
Yeah.
Fair enough. I'll collect all 7 copies and just have them on a shelf and just look at the lovely box art. And
You can follow Tom's recent guide of the Google translation app. You could,
true,
on the dreamcastjunkyard.co.uk.
Yep.
There you go.
You are on it today, Lewis. You are on it.
Plugging away, yeah.
You are. Right, moving swiftly on. I think these games, I don't know if we'll have much to say about them. The next ones are board games, which for Dreamcast, I didn't really know that there were board game type games on the Dreamcast. The first one being Gaia Master Kessen. Anything that anybody can say about that one?
It's a board game.
Great. Moving on.
Pretty much all you need to know. It's actually quite a good game, but if you don't know Japanese, there's no way you're going to know what's going on.
Right, okay. Which I'm guessing is probably going to be the same for the next one, which is Tyson Net Gimmick, Capcom, and Sekiro All-Stars. Is that right?
It's a bit different. I think it's Psycho, isn't it? I think it's... That's how I've said it. I presume it's... Silent T, I think.
Psycho, I guess so. It's spelt Psykyo.
Crazy Japanese people.
Yeah.
it's a Mahjong game. So it's a game developed by Psycho. So whereas Capcom had published some Psycho games, which included Gunbud and Gigawing. So they also did possibly Zero Gunner. Someone's going to murder me for saying this, probably. But whilst Capcom published Gunbird, Psycho managed to do this one, which has basically characters from Psycho games and Capcom games play in Mahjong.
Interesting.
A lot of people pick this game up, think it's a fighting game. It's not a fighting game.
That's like the best bait and switch I could think of. Mahjong's one of them things that people glare at when they see, you know, Japanese sets of games and like, ugh, so many Mahjong games.
Yeah. Things like Mahjong games, as I've gotten older, I quite like the odd occasional Mahjong game. And if there's one with Capcom characters,
yeah,
not too bad. Might be interesting. All right, let's move on. Sport games. Again, not something you really associate with Capcom. Net de Tennis. Was that an online tennis game or is it just... Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. Was it good?
Single player is very limited.
It looks a lot like Capcom's answer to Namco's Smash Court Tennis, the whole visually and the gameplay mechanics of it all. But yeah, there seems to be a character that looks an awful lot like Chun-Li as well, incidentally.
Interesting. So the last, there's a few others that we'll quickly go over, but the last game in the genre list we've got is the puzzle game, which is one I think a lot of people know, which is Super Puzzle Fighter 2 X for Matching Service. So another matching service game. So, Mike, I'm just guessing it's just Super Puzzle Fighter 2, but with online play?
Yep.
Pretty much? Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Not so much else we can say about it, though.
Quite an underrated series, I'd say.
Yeah.
Good fun.
Oh, good fun. Yeah. So there we go. Those are the games that they released. Now, Mike, you've put on this list some others.
Yes.
I don't know if you want to go down those for us and just explain a little bit.
Yeah, so because I know somebody will listen to this and go, well, they've got that wrong. So I'm just going to put some other ones that can be classed as Capcom related. So there's two games that Eidos published in the West. They published in Japan. So Tomb Raider 4, The Last Revelation. It was released in Japan by Capcom, and Sydney 2000, so the tie-in to 2000 Olympic game, was also published in Japan by Capcom, possibly something to do with the fact that they were a rival to Gambare Nippon, which was Konami, I think it was, developed a sports game over there. They also published Ultimate Fighting Championship, which is a bit of an odd one. So it's published by different developers in each region, and they published the Japanese version, probably due to the rights. Most of these games are to do with rights in some way. And the other one, which I didn't actually know was Capcom until I refreshed myself by looking through to make this list, was it's Mobile Suit Gundam EFF versus Zeon and DX, which is published by Bandai, but it was actually a port of a Capcom developed game. I don't think there's any other Capcom-developed games that were released by the publishers, from what I can remember. But yeah, so it was actually a Capcom-developed game originally, which was then ported by Bandai because they held the license. In a similar sort of thing to why F355 Challenge was published by Acclaim in the UK and Europe, because Acclaim held the rights to Ferrari games. Same reason for this one. I think they owned the rights. Bandai might have even actually made... Gundam. I don't watch Gundam. I don't know Gundam. I just know that it was a Capcom game.
That's quite interesting. And Ultimate Fighting Championship, I think, is a little bit of a... It's a fairly good game, I think. I don't know if anybody else is in trouble. I like UFC, and as UFC games go, it's one of the better ones, I think.
Yeah.
Which is pretty nice. And it's an interesting fact that Capcom released in Japan. Okay, well, I think we're coming to the end of the time that we have... as time as a construct is on podcasts, I don't know however much time we have, but we've kind of gone over all these Capcom games. It's been quite interesting to note how many there have been, and actually the vast majority we've had some decent things to say about, which I think says a lot about Capcom and the kinds of games they were producing at the time.
Definitely some good mix of big names and some obscure oddities as well.
I think as far as episodes go about developers, you know, I think it's definitely a thing it'd be cool to come back to. But I feel like this was, other than Sega themselves, this will probably be one of the larger collections of games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it is the biggest one. I think the only publisher that comes close is NEC Interchannel. Published a lot of visual novels in Japan.
That's true. Yeah.
That'd be a hard episode to go
through.
Yeah, another game about schoolgirls. Okay, and the next one.
A solo Mike F, as I think maybe that one.
Yeah. Oh, well, I thoroughly enjoyed that, and I learned a lot about games that some of the games I didn't know, and I learned about games that I did know but didn't know some facts about. So thank you very much, guys. That was really interesting.
There's a few I want to pick up now as well. Yeah. So
same. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let's call it a day there. I'm going to go around a bit. And if you've got kind of want to let people know where you are online and anything else you're doing, let them know. Mike, where can we find you online and what are you up to?
So I'm on Twitter at @space_turnip. I hang around the Dreamcast Junkyard, many accounts. Any hate mail towards me saying something wrong on this podcast can be sent to the usual person. That's tom.charnock. We've got a podcast coming out soon as well. Me and Tom are doing, which is about rally games. I know we've bored some people in the past about rally games. So we are going to do a podcast very, very shortly. But because I'm really unprepared, I haven't got the actual address with me. So therefore, I'm just going to go, yeah, keep an eye out.
Definitely. I'm very excited about listening to that. Some very fond memories of rally games. James, where can we find you online? What are you up to?
You can find me on Twitter. My personal account is at @AgileHarvey. And as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, I am in the middle of launching a Series X podcast, which you can find on seriesxcast.com. And again, follow us on Twitter, which is at @SeriesXcast.
Awesome. Great first episode as well. Looking forward to the second one.
Thank you.
And Lewis, what about you? Where are you? What are you doing?
You can find me on Twitter at @LewisJFC. I mostly probably talk about the Dreamcast Junkyard on there. But I've written a book, and I'm still in the grueling process of trying to get it published, and probably going to be self-releasing. And so I'm trying to get back into that. So there'll probably be a lot more on there about the run up to that, which is something I've been trying to get released for quite a while. So yes, you can also find me on my sort of geek culture website, which is altmag, ALTMAG. The URL is altmaguk.net. I write about non-Dreamcast stuff there, you know, anime and games on other systems. So yeah, check those out, and I will see you all next time.
Excellent. And looking forward to hearing more about the book as well. So for me, you can find me online at Oddmont84. I seem to hang around a lot of places. Obviously, I'm hanging around the junkyard at the moment, but I also hang around the Switch Island, at the Switch Island. I think there's a lot of fans of the Switch around here. I've heard you talking about the Switch games quite a lot. So yeah, seems like a place to go for Dreamcast fans, the Switch at the moment. So it's a great console. You can also find me at the other podcast that I do, which is Dreamcast Years, which is at Dreamcast Years on Twitter, also dreamcastyears.co.uk. So we do a few episodes of that podcast a month, all about the golden age of gaming, which I kind of decided was between 1997 and 2008, which is roughly when the Dreamcast was kind of around and present. Because I think the last official Dreamcast game was released in 2007 in Japan, I believe. Yeah. Oddly, the last licensed one. So I just tacked on a year either end, just because I felt like it. And also, I've just released Dreamcast Year One, which I am forever talking about on DreamPod. It's actually out there now. You can buy a digital copy, and physical copies are coming out very, very soon. So take a look at Oddmont84, and my pinned tweet on there is all about how to pre-order the book. So I'm done plugging about my stuff. Obviously, you can find anything Dreamcast Junkyard related at the DC Junkyard on Twitter, and you can also go to the website thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk, and definitely do, especially because Lewis just released a great article, a great piece of investigative journalism. What was the name of the game again, Lewis? What was the game you were looking into?
Real Racer 9, it's called. Yeah.
Very interesting.
There wasn't a 1-8, but yeah, you can find out more in the article.
Have a read, definitely. All right, well, I think we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much, everybody, and thanks, everybody, for listening. See you next time.